I think the issue is that we need to find a way to be able to talk about what effect that has on financial statements. So if there are, in effect, as I said, serial restatements, if there are certainly repetitions of impairments or adjustments to the financial statements, there has to be a way of asking, what is it that was wrong? Is it internal controls? Is it the fact that we're not actually following the accounting standards? As Joe pointed out, if you look at the number of revenue recognition restatements that you see, you have to ask yourself, is it really that complex? But Joe also pointed out that some of the errors with respect to revenue recognition are fairly simple. How is it possible that we continue to miss that? I found a company the other day that says their auditors have permitted them to apply the multiple element arrangement accounting standard on service transactions, but hasn't asked them to apply it to products. The first line of that standard says that it applies to everything. It starts off actually by saying this standard applies to everything. It doesn't fool around. It doesn't say it in any complex language or anything. How do you do that for 7 years? So those are the kind of, there has to be some way of asking auditors and or finding a way in the financial statements. I think as Charlie said, what is the meaning of fairly presented if I end up with 17 restatements? By the way, I speak of the impairments on basis of having done a fairly extensive study of impairments several years ago. And the repetition of those impairments is just extraordinary. So the specific recommendations, I think we'd have to find a way to be able to talk about these restatements and these impairments.
Bob, and then we've got about 7 more minutes on this panel, so Mike, we'll get to you definitely. Well, we'll get to everybody, and then we'll wrap up, but if you could be fairly brief. And then, actually, Brandon, I think I'd like to give you the last word, because you made some very specific recommendations in your statement. So why don't we spend a little bit more than the 7 minutes, and we'll go right around and conclude. Bob.
Bob Tirola. Thank you, Steve. In the way of recommendations, I would encourage the board to look at the audit function more closely around what boards and managements have to satisfy for SEC requirements or otherwise. To Charlie's point earlier about financial statements being fairly stated, the officer certification says fairly stated. It doesn't say in conformity with GAAP. It stops at fairly stated. That was wise on the SEC's part to truncate that statement. Secondly, I met with auditing firms a few times now, and the topic was, what can we do to, as a CFO and a board member, what can we do to help you? And my answer generally has been focus on the 80% of the things I do, not just on the 20%. The 20% around keeping the books right is fine, but the 80% around risk management, around whistleblowing monitoring, around monitoring operating controls and regulatory controls, around whether or not the business model is still working. Those are the risks that managements and boards are looking at. The auditor is not. The interesting thing is that the disclosure model now requires boards and managements to talk about all of that, whether it's risk factors or enterprise risk management approaches or compensation models. All of that is now in the public domain, yet the auditors almost spend no or very little time assessing those disclosures. And those are the disclosures that mean as much to investors as the accuracy of the balance sheet today, because these are the factors that are going to affect the accuracy of the balance sheet tomorrow.
As a judge, I did get an answer to the question. I asked the question again.
No, we're asking the questions.
I'm asking a very simple question. Do we know what the auditors do when they look at a securitized mortgage? Do we know what they do? They tell us what they do. If they tell us what they do, and then we find out, did they find it or didn't they find it? If they didn't, then they got to change. And I don't know why we're making this thing so complex and the boards. What did the auditors do here? You're an auditor. You're looking at auditing. Did they properly audit something? When your people go in, are they going to ask you, what did they do when they looked at a securitized mortgage? Did they look at it? Did they look at the rating and then give up? Or did they go beyond that? And if they didn't go beyond that, should they go beyond that? Is that, are those hard questions?
Well, I think they're extremely tough questions. I mean, at the end of the day, and I want to get back to you, but not in this session. But you know, during your Keating opinion, you asked the fundamental question: where were the watchdogs? And I remember that vividly.
Right.
And we'll get back to that later on today. But I think it's a very difficult question to figure out exactly what the role of the watchdog is.
Well, what did they do? We don't know what they did. Let's find out what they did.
Well. I think that's part and parcel of what we're getting at directly with respect to one of the items the fraud center is going to be looking at. So let's keep on going around, and we'll have to wrap this one up pretty shortly, but let's take the extra time so that we hear from everybody.
Just to, I have to applaud and appreciate comments Bob and Joe both have made, and this is Mike Head to get back to announcing, that when you talk about, and I call it the iceberg theory, I've done that for years. That may not make any sense to other people, but what I mean by iceberg theory is the financial statements are what's above water when you're talking about an iceberg. And it's the smallest piece of what's going on. So Bob and Joe are alluding to, in the full COSO framework, where you have financial reporting, operating efficiency and effectiveness, and compliance with applicable laws and regulations, the iceberg, part of the iceberg you can see is the financial reporting. A lot of us that are historical accountants and auditors will call that the scorekeeping, are very important because it's what investors see and rely on in making their decisions. But where you manage risk, where governance is implemented, where you are trying to prevent fraud and hold management accountable and the board is trying to do what they're saying, that's the large portion of that iceberg is the operating procedures and the compliance portions that, by design, the auditor's opinion is not intended to cover except indirectly. And it's why one of the things from a broker-dealer point of view, that as things from the whatever center you set up or you're talking about trying to influence what auditors can do, that's why a SAS 70 type of approach and why I applaud where the SEC went with the custodial rules and modifying it. If there's something that management, boards, PCAOB, and the SEC feels are critical for the safeguarding of assets and the protection of the investors, to get at that, you can't do that through the financial statements and an audit opinion of the financial statements. You have to look at it at the operational and compliance control structure, and the best way to get to that is not through the vehicle of material misstatement and fair statement of financial statements. It's by doing a service audit that falls under the SAS 70 Type 2 audit. So if we think custody controls is where we're really concerned about protecting investors' assets, then you require them to do a SAS 70 covering a period that's covering the operating and compliance procedures, and you don't try to get at that through the financial statements. If someone thinks there's elements that come out of the postmortem of this fraud stuff that are critical to protect the investors, and it's operational relied upon, then you go to something like the SEC custodial rules and you put a rule in place that requires management and the auditing firm to look at the controls around those operating procedures. And if governance and compensation are things that hit that hot button, then you include them in a required audit of operating procedures, not try to get at it through just disclosure and financial statement presentation. You'll never get there. And that's what you and Joe are saying, Bob, But that's not what a financial statement audit opinion is trying to give you comfort on. A SAS 70 or other targeted controls are. FINRA put into place a few years ago the requirement for the compliance structure to be certified and reported on. If you took 404 and expanded it to be, we want you to opine on the COSO framework and not make it a point in time at year end, but to make it for the operating year of the for the company, and you made it cover financial, operating, and compliance, and turn that into a service type audit for the company, and you would get much further than trying to disclose the world in the financial statements. But that's just me. I'll get off my soapbox.
Pete, we do welcome your comment, even though you...
Okay, I'll try and keep it brief. Otherwise, I was going to cede my time to the gentleman from Teachers, since I know you wanted to end where you began. But just two quick things on practical guidance. I think, you know, since the beginning of time, in terms of looking at fraud, it's almost always been hidden in the same places. So, you know, as somebody said earlier, unrealized gains, or it's stuck in inventory, you know, et cetera. How do we come up with, you know, the practical guidance, and particularly gets at the new things that are always being created, whether being created on Wall Street or being created other places, because there's a reason the Madoff scandal was referred to as a Ponzi scheme. You know, we've talked a bit about things are new, but, you know, Ponzi's been around for 100 years. So what can we learn from the old ones, but then how do we stay on the leading edge of the new ones? And then lastly, we talked a lot about risk and risk disclosures, and, you know, how can the PCAOB collaborate with other standard setters and regulatory bodies to come up with some sort of a framework around risk disclosures. Again, it's not necessarily up to the auditors to disclose those in the financials. Maybe we should ask them to disclose it in their opinions, but I think having management disclose it in their financials and having the auditors responsible for reviewing risk disclosure, I think, could be helpful.
Well, we're clearly going to get to that a little bit later. Brandon?
I think it's Kierkegaard who said something like, life is understood looking backwards but lived going forward. It seems to me that your advisory committee universally supports a fraud center and urges you to implement it promptly and robustly. We also support it focusing on old-time fraud, whether it's Ponzi or salad oil, and looking for ways to make sure that we avoid those instances again. We also think that in terms of lessons learned, whether it's Lynn's more subtle problems, Ann's structural issues, or Tony's individual concerns, that there are more important concerns that go beyond fraud, or at least of equal importance, which go to risk and its measurement and the assessment of risk above and beyond the focus on the financial statements. The ability to make sure that fairly presented appropriately incorporates an assessment of risk is an important aspect that we would hope to see a fraud center, or as Ann might amend that, a fools in fraud center, would take into consideration on a going forward basis. We also, at least at TIA CREF, think that looking at some particulars, even if you don't take on the entire comprehensive assessment, whether it's Rule 105 or the quality of earnings, and in our view, whether or not we're picking up the entire earnings life cycle of a financial instrument, are areas that warrant further consideration on a going forward basis. But the core message, I think, of your group is we need a fraud center that's robust, and we need to not only deal with regular way fraud, we need to deal with systemic risk assessment issues on an ongoing basis.
Commissioner Walter.
Thank you, Steve. I applaud everything that I've heard this morning, and although keeping in mind that, of course, I must disclaim speaking for anyone else at the Commission, hopefully I speak for myself, I think it's also important, and I think what you've heard coming here today, is to think about in setting up a fraud center, and I agree with Brandon, it really needs to go beyond fraud and not involve labeling yourself as having committed fraud, which perhaps is even more important, that you need to set out at the first instance the kinds of things you may come up with and to cooperate with other people. And it strikes me, we've heard a lot this morning about a variety of different levels. At base, what we really want to accomplish is what one might call the impossible dream, which is to change ethics and culture and behavior so that everyone does the right thing. And we need to strive for that, even though we know we can't get there. and you need to think about coming out with solutions that involve incentives for good behavior, prophylactics and sanctions for bad behavior, and a combination of rules and principles, not to use what have become really trite terms, and think about the kinds of solutions, and also, given your focus on auditors, also working with other people who can focus on other people who are involved in the chain in terms of coming up with recommendations. And I know I look forward to working with you on it, and I'm sure my colleagues at the Commission do that as well.
Well, thank you very much. That's a terrific closing to the first panel. A very helpful summary, and Commissioner Walter, we certainly appreciate that endorsement and support for the Center. Why don't we take a 15-minute break and reconvene at 10 after 11. All right, I'd like to ask Commissioner Chairman Geltzer to start the next forum on foreign inspections. So, Dan, let me turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Steve. I'll just be brief and set in a little bit of the background. I think I've said publicly on other occasions that I regard one of the most serious and challenging problems that the PCAOB currently faces as our inability to make comprehensive and fully effective our foreign inspection program. We have approximately 930 accounting firms registered with us outside of the United States that are located in 87 different jurisdictions. So we have, in that sense, worldwide responsibilities. Not all of those 930 firms are required to be inspected because many of them are not actually issuing audit reports that are filed with the SEC and therefore don't come within the scope of our existing inspection program, but at least several hundred of them are required to be periodically inspected. We do have an active foreign inspection program, and I don't want to leave the impression that we're not performing inspections outside the United States. In the 6 years or so that our inspection program has been operating, we've conducted about 200 inspections of non-U.S.-based firms in 33 different jurisdictions. Many of those inspections were conducted jointly with the home country audit oversight body, and as a general matter, when there is an inspection program operating in a country, we usually would try to conduct our inspections jointly with the home country authority. This year, in 2010, we are scheduled, required under our inspection frequency rules, to conduct an additional 91 inspections in 26 different countries. So, what's the problem? There are major obstacles to us being able to conduct the inspections that the Sarbanes-Oxley Act expects and requires us to conduct. Currently, we are unable to conduct inspections in any of the countries in the European Union, in China, or in Switzerland. As to China, we are conducting inspections in Hong Kong, although there are some issues about work paper access in some cases there. I don't have complete market cap figures as to how that affects our inability to perform these inspections affects U.S. investors, but I think it's safe to say that it has a very important or profound effect on them. The market cap, the U.S. market cap of foreign private issuers in the places that we're unable to inspect is certainly in the hundreds of billions of dollars, but probably at least a trillion based on the numbers we have. You can add to that, that would just be the range of market cap for foreign private issuers where their auditor is located outside the United States. Obviously, in many cases, even though the signing auditor is in the United States, a substantial amount of the audit work is performed by a non-U.S. Audit firm. I think for example, in the Lehman audit, the last Lehman audit that was performed, seems to have been in the news somewhat lately, almost half the assets were located outside the United States, and almost half the audit work was therefore performed by firms outside the United States. we certainly aren't taking this problem calmly, and we're trying to proceed on a number of different fronts to solve it. Perhaps the most obvious is negotiating with the audit oversight authorities in these places where we're not currently permitted to enter, to try and resolve the issues of sovereignty or privacy of information or whatever the objection might be. We believe that the enactment of the financial services legislation that's currently pending in Congress would be an important step for us, because that contains a provision that would let us share inspection information with foreign oversight, audit oversight bodies on the same terms that we can share information domestically. At least in some cases, our inability to engage in that kind of sharing is one of the objections that's been raised to our ability to come into the EU particularly and perform inspections. We're also, I think, mindful of the fact that investors do need to have information about our inability to conduct inspections in some cases. We now have information on our website about firms that we've been unable to inspect despite the fact that the inspection cycle has passed for them. Those are generally, I guess, without exception, foreign firms. And we're thinking about whether that disclosure should be expanded, perhaps to include the clients of those firms. There are other tools in our regulatory kit which we might be able to use. For example, additional requirements for U.S. auditors, signing auditors who rely on the work of foreign firms that we're not able to inspect, whether they should have to make some disclosure, have additional requirements with respect to themselves having possession of foreign work papers, other things in that range. And, of course, ultimately, we also have enforcement tools that could be brought to bear against foreign firms that we're unable to inspect, although that using those tools would raise its own set of policy issues. So that's probably longer than you intended, Steve, but my kickoff to this discussion. I'd certainly be interested to hear this group's views.
Thanks, Jim and Gelser. You hit on some of the issues that we're going to hit on. This is a topic that we were assigned by Steve and Joanne and worked collaboratively. I'm going to make the presentation, but worked collaboratively on these slides with Barbara Roper from the Consumer Federation of America and Ann Yerger from the Council of Institutional Investors. And again, for the benefit of the webcast, I'm Joe Carcello. You have the slides in front of you. Quickly, as you look at the slides, what we're going to talk about is just some very quick background information on the Act, current state of the inspections, challenges, number and size of foreign registrants, relative size of international subs. We looked a little bit at PCAOB inspection resources and rigor, lack of access by the PCAOB inspectors to certain foreign countries, the other independent audit regulators. As Steve requested, we do make some recommendations for the board's consideration and then to maybe jumpstart conversation, some questions for the group, but we could easily deviate from those questions. So this is the inspection mandate per the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Again, you have it on the slide, so I won't read this to you. You have it in front of you. And the intent of the inspections to evaluate the sufficiency of the firm's quality control system and the manner of documentation and communication of that system by the firm. The scope covers any registered public accounting firm that audits a company traded on a U.S. exchange, regardless of domicile. So I think one thing that's important to understand is the United States Congress would have been aware of some of these territorial claims that have been asserted at the time they passed the law, and the United States Congress chose to indicate that all firms registered with the board, regardless of domicile, should be inspected. There are approximately 2,500 firms registered with the board, including about 40 firms from 86 foreign countries outside the U.S. Frequency annually for registered public accounting firms that regularly audit more than 100 issuers. There's 10 all in the United States, at least once every 3 years for other registered public accounting firms that have issued an audit report on an issuer during the preceding year, at least one audit report. Our numbers suggest that there's approximately 450 firms in the U.S. and 200 firms outside the U.S. that would be subject to inspection requirements, so about 650, and then the 10 that are the very large firms, 660. No exemptions. All non-U.S. firms must register with the PCAOB. And the intent of this is it ensures compliance with the PCAOB's auditing and professional standards, inspections, and disciplinary regimes. There had been some discussion by the board of a full reliance approach on foreign regulators at the moment. It looks like the board's leaning against that approach based on PCAOB release 2004-05. PCAOB retains overall authority over inspections, investigation, and enforcements. They did make a proposal for full reliance in 2007. No actions taken, going on 3 years, so my gut says, at least right now, that's probably cool. High cooperation. PCAOB cooperates as much as possible with counterparts around the globe. PCAOB Rule 4012 deals with foreign inspections and may rely on an independent audit oversight entities located in home countries of registered non-U.S. firms, and to the extent that the board relies on these other independent audit regulators, here are the characteristics that the board considers. Challenges, as Chairman Gelser said, there's a number of challenges posed by foreign inspections. Not all registered non-U.S. firms have been inspected. As of the end of 2009, 70 foreign firms in 25 foreign countries had not been inspected, even though more than 4 years had passed since the end of the year in which the firm first issued an audit report while registered with the PCAOB. So we're talking, if you kind of do the math there, right, guys and gals, that's 5 years or more. PCAOB difficulties inspecting some registered non-U.S. firms, access denied to PCAOB based on legal conflicts with home country laws or objections based on national sovereignty. Chairman Gelser has indicated some of the actions the board has already taken. Disclose names of firms not yet inspected. Disclose names of jurisdictions that deny access. There's been a deferral in getting all this done for 2012. Proposed legislation that the chairman alluded to that may end up as part of the financial regulatory bill. We also need to understand that the largest auditing firms are composed of global networks of affiliates. Affiliates are separate legal entities. I question whether most U.S. investors understand that. Independent and autonomous. Affiliates of a U.S. accounting firm may be subject to quality assurance, risk management, overall business reviews, codes of ethics and professional conduct, and practice rules. So they do attempt to integrate on some of these dimensions, but in terms of legal structure, they typically are separate. Audits of global clients, as Dan said, are handled by affiliated firms. When I was in public accounting, we had a few multinationals, and we never were getting on planes jetting around the globe. We used the foreign affiliates of our firm to do that work. Foreign registrants audited by non-U.S. auditors are significant to the capital markets, the U.S. capital markets. We used audit analytics, and a little over 10% of all companies on audit analytics, which is most of the SEC universe, it's around 9,000. Public companies, over 10% are foreign registrants. Some market cap numbers, European Union and Norway over 500 billion, Switzerland over 75 billion, China and Hong Kong over 75 billion. It's hard to get exact numbers on this, as Chairman Gelser indicated, but these are big numbers no matter how you slice it. And keep in mind that these foreign registrants are not being audited by the big four firms that we all know and love here in the United States. So I'm handing out another piece of paper for you that I think you'll find quite interesting. And this piece of paper, we took the 50 largest foreign registrants. Okay, so this is the 50 foreign registrants. And we looked to see who signed the opinion. Seems interesting, right? Six different flavors of Deloitte. 10 different flavors of Ernst. 9 different flavors of KPMG. And 10 different flavors of PwC. So I have some questions just to spur your intellectual curiosity this morning. Do U.S. investors even realize that some of these entities are not the U.S. firm? Okay? So let's look at PricewaterhouseCoopers. Remember tick marks from public accounting? Remember that, Lynn? A and B. PricewaterhouseCoopers, in brackets, that's me. That's not on the signature. Okay, so it says PricewaterhouseCoopers in brackets Hong Kong. That's not, it's on the signature to the extent that they put the city and state or the country and so forth. But they don't call it PricewaterhouseCoopers Hong Kong. They call it PricewaterhouseCoopers. Now, you think if a U.S. investor saw that, what would they think? Okay? Where is it obvious, where it is obvious that the firm is not a U.S. firm? I love KPMG's affiliate in Germany. I can't even write the thing. Would U.S. investors think this is a wholly owned sub of a U.S. firm? I think some of them would. Do U.S. investors realize that in the case of litigation, that each of these firms are generally legally separate entities? And there are 35 separate affiliated Big Four firms on this list in 15 countries, approximately 15 countries. Do investors expect a Big Four firm to deliver uniform audit quality given a U.S. listing and compliance with PCAOB standards? I would think the answer to that is yes. And is that happening? That's obviously an empirical question, and obviously why foreign inspections are so important. In addition to what we did with foreign registrants, as Chairman Gelser indicated, the thing that worries me as much as the foreign registrants is U.S. multinationals. That's where so much of our market cap is, and a huge amount of the work is being done overseas by foreign affiliate firms. So what we did is we pulled the geographic area disclosures, and I need to thank Matt Hogue and Derek Hobby, who are students at the University of Tennessee, who actually did a lot of this. This was a significant amount of data pulling in a short period of time, but advantages of being at a university. Geographic area disclosures, the old FAS 131, for the Fortune 100. And what we did is we looked at revenues, foreign revenues to total revenues, and foreign assets to total assets. And we also looked at the number of subsidiaries, both domestic subsidiaries and U.S. subsidiaries. So if you use medians, you see that there's about 113 subsidiaries for these companies, 28 of which are foreign. So that's what? More than 25% of the subsidiaries of the Fortune 100 are outside the United States. If you compare international revenues, if you do it based on companies that include all companies, if you include all companies, including those with no international revenue, mean revenue to total revenue is 24%, mean assets to total assets are 16%. If you exclude companies with no international revenue, some companies that are just purely U.S. domestic, mean revenue from foreign operations to total revenue is 36%. Mean assets to total assets are 30%. So however you slice it, it's a very significant chunk of U.S. multinational financial statements. We also looked, tried to compare the PCAOB inspection process here in the United States to the PCAOB inspection process of foreign affiliates. This was difficult to do with any degree of reliability using the public portions of inspection reports. So we kind of cheated. We used the PCAOB's Office of Internal Oversight and Performance Assurance report that was issued on December 4th, 2009. And this is a public document. It's been submitted to the chairman of the SEC with Chairman Gelser's cover letter. So there's nothing that the board and the SEC don't know here. But issues related to rigor of some international inspections, particularly related to documentation scope, consideration of risk and reliance on foreign regulators, until recently is a lack of a system of accountability. So even in, not to be unkind, but even where the board is getting in, there are still issues. Even where they're able to get in and do inspections, it's not going probably as smoothly as they would like. And then there's the issue of lack of access by PCAOB inspectors to certain foreign countries. And among these countries, as again as the chairman indicated, China, third in the world in gross domestic product, Germany, fourth in the world in gross domestic product, France, fifth in the world in gross domestic product, the United Kingdom, sixth in the world in gross domestic product. So you're covered here in the U.S. You're okay if you're in Boston or L.A. or Atlanta, and you're okay if you're in Japan, because they're second in GDP. Other than that, you got an issue. Other than that, you got an issue. Okay, then we looked at independent audit regulators and their inspection regimes. So we focused on examining the independent audit regulator in the 10 largest countries based on gross domestic product. Website content and reporting was sporadic and inconsistent across various countries. So this is rough. This is rough. This was not any degree of uniformity here. But most usable reports, in our judgment, were from the U.S., Japan, U.K., Italy, and Canada. Reports were not available in English for France and Germany, and we were not, and we were unable to locate reports for China, Brazil, and Spain. It appeared that the board of the independent audit regulator was independent in the U.S., Japan, Germany, U.K., and Canada. The board does not appear to be independent in Italy and Brazil, and we could not determine if the board was independent in China, France, and Spain. Also, in Japan and Canada, there aren't separate inspection reports on the big four firms, but rather they issue a combined report. We also looked at kind of resources available. So for the 2008 fiscal year, the PCAOB's operating expenses were approximately $134 million, $9 million in Canada, $5 million in the U.K. PCAOB had 258 inspection employees. Japan had 39, Canada had 24, and the U.K. had 18. In 2008, the PCAOB completed 255 inspections. Canada completed 42. The United Kingdom completed 19. Japan completed 120, but it appeared to us it was done by what I'll call the Japanese analog of the AICPA. So since the United States Congress has specifically rejected that approach, I put that down kind of indented, not at the same level of not comparable to the others. Okay, so in addition, reasoning by analogy, let's compare U.S. securities regulator. This is for you, Commissioner Walter. With international securities regulators. So from 1987 to 1997, there were 300 enforcement actions by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Not 300, 300 unique companies. There were many more enforcement actions. So not uncommon for there to be two or three or four enforcement actions coming out of one case, right? The company and the management of the company and maybe the auditor. 300 unique, what I'll call, instances of fraud. In the study that will be released in a couple of weeks, there's 350. So fraud's not going away. It's becoming slightly more prevalent. It's lasting a little longer. And as you'll see when the study comes out, the size of the fraud is significantly larger. So, and even if we truncate at the 95th percentile, Lynn, and take Enron and WorldCom out, it's still significantly larger. There's a study in Canada by Magnon and all, et al. In 2010, 15 enforcement actions over the 11-year period from 1995 to 2005 in Canada, other than the United Kingdom, probably the country closest to us in terms of culture and background and so forth. So being a good academic, I have a rhetorical question. You don't have to answer, right? That's what a good rhetorical question is for the group. Given the difference in the apparent rigor of the enforcement program between the U.S. securities regulator and at least one foreign counterpart, why should we expect the rigor of inspections between the U.S. independent audit regulator and foreign independent audit regulators to be any different? Not saying it can't be, but that somebody'd have to come up with a good reason as to why it would be. So recommendations for the PCAOB per Steve's request. Redouble efforts to get access to these foreign accounting firms through political and diplomatic negotiations. In our view, me and Barbara and Ann, the board should not take any of its options off the table at this point. Deregistering foreign accounting firms where inspections cannot be conducted. We're not suggesting the board go there first by any stretch of the imagination. But in any negotiation, to take your strongest weapon off the table before the negotiation starts strikes us as ill-advised. In the interim, the board should require disclosure of names of foreign registered accounting firms that have not been inspected. This is already being done, Chairman Gelser indicated. Names of foreign registrants in countries where inspections have not occurred. Name the companies. As Dan suggested, they're not there yet, but they've talked about that. Names of U.S. multinationals, if material foreign subsidiaries have been audited by foreign accounting firms that have not been inspected, and the percentages of consolidated revenues, income, and assets of foreign subs audited by foreign accounting firms that have not been inspected. So if Gus is sitting up there in Valley Forge And he says, I've got this audit report, and it says 60% of consolidated revenues, income, and assets have been audited by foreign affiliates in countries that maybe he's concerned about transparency and the rule of law and so forth. And there's no inspection going on of the audit work in that country. Then as the investor, he has a choice to make. He's fully informed. He doesn't have lack of information. He may say, I don't care. I don't care. I'm still going to own that stock. Or he may say, no, forewarned is forearmed. I don't want to own the stock. In addition, for foreign subs of U.S. multinationals audited by foreign affiliates of a U.S. firm, the board should require the U.S. accounting firm to conduct detailed internal inspection of its foreign affiliates. I think this is what the chairman was getting at. The board could put in place additional requirements on the U.S. firm that's relying on the work of the foreign affiliate. Okay? And so the foreign government may block the board. You use the U.S. firm as your proxy. Review these internal inspections and inspect its division of enforcement. I want to make sure that Claudius doesn't get bored. To hold U.S. accounting firms responsible for the failures of their foreign affiliates when auditing material foreign subsidiaries of U.S. multinationals. And then we have questions, but we obviously will talk about whatever you guys want to talk about. So hopefully I tried to do that quickly because I wanted to make sure there's plenty of time for people to talk. So,
could I just ask you one quick question? On your recommendations, you don't seem to have linked the ability to do inspections to convergence issues. And do you see a connection between those two?
The ability to do inspections to convergence of accounting standards or auditing standards?
Accounting standards.
Or
do you view that as two independent conversations, parallel tracks that shouldn't be connected?
If there's a Venn diagram, there's overlap. I don't, we might have different opinions as to how much overlap there is, but there's certainly overlap. As you rightly point out now, certainly on foreign registrants, in all likelihood, they're filing with the SEC using IFRS as issued by the IASB. Now, that won't be the case for foreign subs of U.S. multinationals. They'll still be using U.S. GAAP. So for that part of it, no issue, right? But for foreign registrants, yeah, there's obviously an issue that the board is going to need the capacity in an inspection sense to not only evaluate auditing, which is still the same, PCAOB standards are still the same, but be able to evaluate the application of IFRS effectively for these foreign registrants. Because, yeah, you're right, that's a fair point. And that's a capability they need to have in place to be able to do that effectively. Yeah.
I'm surprised, Joe, that you're not to move on from accounting standards to talk about international auditing standards, that there's no recommendation that relates to that and to moving forward with people around the globe through IFIAR and otherwise towards having auditing standards converge, because even if you solve the inspections problem, if you've got a variety of qualities of auditing standards, the problem is still in some ways going to persist. So
yeah.
I would think that ought to be on the table as well.
It is on the agenda for today, Commissioner Walter. It wasn't specifically our charge, but I'll say a couple of things about it. At least my understanding that if you're a foreign registrant and you're filing with the SEC, regardless of the country you're in, you can use IFRS right now, but you still have to do the audit using PCAOB auditing standards. And so you might be in Brazil and you might be using ISAs, and my understanding is most of the big four, their underlying platform, their audit methodology platform is based on the ISAs, the International Standards of Auditing. But then for companies that file with the SEC, they lay on top of that any incremental PCAOB requirements. Now, a discussion of whether or not the PCAOB should move in the direction of adopting the ISAs broadly, I think we'll have that discussion later. And so I don't want to take it too far afield. I did look at the IAASB, and I'm sure you've looked at it as well. And when you look at that and you look at the current composition of the IAASB, and it's 18 people, and you count the people who are currently I'm not talking about past, because Marty's past, and he heads up inspections here for the PCAOB, who are currently working in public accounting. It's about 50%. And it's heavily represented by the Big Four, which, again, was the model we had at the Auditing Standards Board. That was the model that, you know, I've had since I was in my 20s, that Charlie had when he practiced accounting, that Dan had for the few years he was in accounting. And the United States Congress specifically rejected that approach. Okay, now they gave the board the option of delegating standard setting. The board has chosen not to do that. And
I guess the point I'm making is a little bit different than that. Not so much necessarily a movement towards international auditing standards, but rather the notion that if you look at the Big Four and you say their platform is based on one set of standards with others as an add-on, that's not necessarily the healthiest underlying condition. I mean, long-term, if the issues that underlie this issue are going to be solved, you want one very robust set of auditing standards to be applied across the board. And that, I think, is particularly troublesome when you sort of have things as an add-on, because it's not what you do daily. And remembering that I have to do extra things for this guy, but not for that guy, is not a good thing.
Yeah, no, you're right. That's a good point. I think the discussion is, how do you get to one set of global auditing standards, the same as one set of global accounting standards, that are uniformly high quality in the investor's best interest and promulgated by bodies that are independent of the profession itself. And right now, the IAASB, at least in my view, is not quite there. But I think, Steve, that's on the agenda for later today, isn't it?
I think it's on the agenda for later today. I don't know whether Marty Baumann wants to take a brief moment to discuss, you know, our standard-setting process, and it will be brief, but the fact of the matter is Sarbanes-Oxley, the spirit, the vision of the underlying bill was that the PCAOB be the gold standard in terms of setting standards. And for this particular group, I think it's important to know that first and foremost, in terms of our standard setting, or if not first and foremost, certainly a very, very high priority, is how do they improve from an investor protection standpoint the standards that are already out there. And so we're doing a very, very careful analysis of the interim standards, the international standards, in terms of setting our own standards. But Marty, do you want to take a second and just... If he's here.
I anticipated you and I moved right
on. Good. All right. Oh, I didn't see it. Thank you.
Well, I think Joe has kind of alluded to some of the points that are important in this regard, and Steve, you did also, that Congress in Sarbanes-Oxley intended for standard setting to change, intended for a lot of things to change in the oversight of auditing. And right now, standard setting is in the hands of an independent regulator, as opposed to standard setting largely dominated by the profession, as Joe Carcello just pointed out. So we are writing and updating and writing a lot of new standards. We look to see what the international and other standard setters have done, but we take a thorough and comprehensive look, and we add whatever requirements we think are appropriate to have the what we think are the highest quality auditing standards that are that can be inspected against and can be appropriately enforced, and therefore can result in the highest degree of audit quality. So we have an ambitious standard-setting agenda and program that we think will achieve those goals.
And Barbara, why don't we turn to you, and then Damon, and thank you for, first of all, testifying for the public service, whatever you said. Thank you for getting out of that hearing as quickly as you could and joining us on this panel. We did miss you on the first panel, but we welcome you here. So, Barbara, why don't we start with you and then Damon.
You know me well enough, Steve, to know you shouldn't issue those kind of blanket thank yous when I get in front of a microphone. But, I mean, Joe did us his service of giving us credit on his presentation for contributing, and I think Ann did. I did essentially nothing. There may be one sentence in this which I contributed, which is not an effort on my part to walk away from it, but I think Joe did a terrific job, and he put a lot of work into it, and I think it shows. On this issue, of what was raised. It's, you know, how does this issue relate to IFRS and audit standard convergence? I feel very strongly that it does not relate to them at all. There is a mandate in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act that the PCAOB inspect foreign firms. It was, an effort was made in committee to strip that out. In the conference committee, both Senator Graham and Representative Oxley attempted to strip that out in conference committee. It was rejected, and it was rejected in face of all of the arguments that had been brought to bear by another number of foreign entities. So Congress thought about this long and hard. They made this decision, and they made it despite considerable opposition. So I think it has to be taken very seriously that they view this as an absolutely essential component of effective PCAOB operations. On the questions of the international audit standards, those of us who lobbied on this legislation fought very hard to ensure that this body would have the authority to set the audit standards, and that we would change a system in which audit standard setting was dominated by the industry, because we felt that it had given us standards that were written primarily to protect, or with an excessive eye toward protecting the auditors from liability rather than resulting in effective audits. And given the current state of affairs in the international audit standard setting process, to move too precipitously toward some sort of international convergence with standards would simply put us right back to the system, as Joe suggested, that Congress specifically rejected when it offered this model. We would be back to having considerable and excessive, in my view, input from the auditors in the setting of those standards, and that would not, I think, benefit the standards themselves. Which doesn't mean there shouldn't be some sort of general discussion of trying to move in the same direction and reach agreement when it's possible, but it can't become an end in itself. Beyond that, I think there's something of a myth about the benefits of this, even in a theoretical sense, which is the idea that uniform standards would produce uniform audits. We know, for example, with IFRS, that uniform accounting standards don't produce uniform accounting. There is at least some sort of theoretical logic to having one language that everybody speaks in terms of accounting standards. I just don't see the same logic on audit standards, and I think that if you don't solve this basic problem first of getting the inspections and the enforcement and everything working, that simply moving towards comparable standards won't do anything to get us closer, anything significant to get us closer to comparable audits. It's really on this end of getting the inspections system functioning that we need to bring us all closer together to performing the highest quality audits.